Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today because we are going to be speaking to Dr. Lachlan McNamee about his book titled Settling for Less: Why States Colonize and Why They Stop. It's just come out from Princeton University Press, and as the title states, this deals with a pretty important question, not just explaining why states colonize. That would be worthy of a book in and of itself, but this book actually even goes further to also explain why states stop colonizing, either stop at a particular place and don't go further, or attempt a colonization, realize it's not working out, and then move backwards. This is a historical book. This is a current book. And essentially, this explains a whole lot about the world, where we're at now, how we got here. And it's really, really fascinating. So I'm very excited for this conversation. Lachlan, thank you so much for being here to talk to us.
Thanks, Miranda. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about the book with you.
Before we dive into the book, though, can you tell us maybe about the origin story of it? If you could introduce yourself and explain why you decided to write this?
So I am a political scientist. I'm currently working at Monash University in Australia and UCLA. I guess, growing up in Australia, have long been, the key issue in Australia's history is kind of the horrific treatment of Indigenous peoples continues to be kind of the major political issue to the current day. But my interest in this subject is both personal for that reason, but also comparative. When I left high school, I lived in China for a while and learned Chinese. And when I was in China, there was a lot of news about Han Chinese people moving to kind of frontier areas like Tibet and Xinjiang and displacing Indigenous peoples there. And I would often raise this with my Chinese friends and we'd get into heated debates. And I would, say how horrible this is and how could the government be doing this and why is it doing this? And they would, throw it back on me and be like, we're simply doing exactly what the Australian government did to Indigenous people. So how could you be in a position to criticize the Chinese government? So I guess the book started way back then when from a kind of a precocious teenager interested in thinking about, comparing colonization projects in the global south in places like China and thinking about how they're similar and different to kind of the history of Western colonialism in the 1800s and 1900s.
That's a very interesting sort of point of debate to start a project from, and very much makes sense in a way of kind of what the book has ended up as. But before we get into kind of the number of examples you look at and explaining the logic of colonialism and why states stop, we should probably start with some definitions. Most importantly, what do you mean by colonization?
Sure. In the book, I distinguish between imperialism, which is states annexing territory in kind of frontier areas formerly not under their control, which is, you know, how we often refer to, say, Russian imperialism in eastern Ukraine at the moment, and colonization. So colonization I define as the practice whereby states displace indigenous peoples and import new populations of settlers who are ethnically distinct. And I define it in this way because colonization originates in the Roman word colonus or farmer. So it was coined originally to describe the Roman practice of when it annexed new territories, it would send farmers to those territories to kind of claim those areas on behalf of the Roman state. And, you know, this is often what we mean when we say, you know, bees or birds or other animals, you know, colonize new territory. They kind of move into those territories and set up shop. So it has this kind of ecological definition to it. And so when I use the term colonization in the book, I use it to refer to humans when they forcibly go into a new territory and displace a pre-existing population and establish a new state. And this refers to both, say, European colonization, say, white people moving to Australia in the 1800s, or to ongoing colonization projects in the global south today, whether that be, you know, Israeli settlements in the West Bank, or Chinese settlements in Xinjiang, or Indonesian settlements in West Papua.
Thank you for explaining that. I think we're going to get into a number of those examples, kind of with the one you've mentioned most recently, because you actually start the book with New Guinea. Why do you start there?
Yeah, so I begin the book with a kind of contrast between two states. And so the island of New Guinea was divided in half between Indonesia and Australia for most of the 20th century. And the western half of the island, or West Papua, is kind of a key case where we can see colonization occurring today or in very recent history. So Indonesia annexed the western half of New Guinea in the 1960s. And since then, it's had a kind of long-running independence movement from the indigenous population who've been trying to establish their own nation state. Now, in order to defeat and prevent kind of West Papua's secession from the rest of Indonesia, Indonesia in the 1980s and 90s settled about 300,000 people from its core islands to West Papua, luring people with the promise of land from islands like Java and Bali, and displaced tens of thousands of West Papuans, which turned West Papuans, the indigenous population, into a minority in much of the island. And so Indonesia's policies in West Papua present us with this kind of puzzle, I guess, similar to China in Xinjiang, of a state ostensibly committed to anti-colonialism, nonetheless engaging in policies that look highly colonial and kind of displacing indigenous populations and importing new populations of settlers. So the western half of the island was colonized by Indonesia, but the eastern half of the island was controlled by Australia until the 1970s. But bizarrely, and perhaps contrary to our expectation, Australia, this kind of canonical settler colonial state that displaced much of the indigenous population on the mainland Australia, did not colonize Papua New Guinea. So Papua New Guinea had very few whites for most of the 20th century. And in fact, in the 1970s, Australia pushed for Papua New Guinea to become independent. So Papua New Guinea was in some ways willingly decolonized by Australia. So we have this kind of strange juxtaposition here. On one hand, the state in Indonesia, committed to anti-colonialism, became a colonizer in New Guinea. And in Australia, this state committed to white supremacy became the kind of willing decolonizer in New Guinea. And so I simply ask, you know, what's going on here? What explains this contrast?
So there, of course, are explanations for why states colonize and how they do it and where and when that could potentially answer this question you've posed. But obviously, if the traditional answers were sufficient, you wouldn't have written the book. So what is the traditional answer and why do you think it doesn't seem to work?
Yeah, so, you know, there are kind of two main schools of thought to explain why states colonize indigenous peoples. So the first school of thought is kind of explains colonization through racial ideologies. So we expect that a state like Australia, committed to white supremacy, or a state like Israel, committed to Zionism, kind of a commitment to maintaining kind of ethnic purity of a state, should be more likely to displace an indigenous population and settle their lands with members of a dominant group. But you know, building from that New Guinea contrast, the explanation doesn't really help make sense of these cases, right? Because Indonesia, the state ostensibly committed to anti-colonialism, to racial equality, became the colonizer in New Guinea. In Australia, the state committed to white supremacy for much of the 20th century, to the White Australia policy, became the willing decolonizer in New Guinea, did not colonize New Guinea. So in some ways, a commitment to racial supremacy becomes neither a necessary nor sufficient explanation for colonization. Something else must be going on to kind of explain this difference that we see in the world. And the other kind of dominant explanation for why states colonize explains colonization through the economic interests of states, right? So Patrick Wolfe and other scholars writing in post-colonial theory and kind of Marxist theory explain colonization basically by when states kind of annex territory that where the land is seen as potentially productive for agriculture and is populated by an indigenous group that isn't seen as a valuable labor force, then this theory predicts that states will displace that population and actively settle those lands with farmers from the core to kind of increase the amount of taxable income. And then this perspective basically explains variation in colonization through the economic interests of states. They'll only settle areas that are productive, agricultural areas, where settler mortality isn't too high, or where the terrain is suitable. And so I critique this perspective because I say it's kind of logically inconsistent. Because if we think of that states are going to try and economically exploit frontier areas, then we have to think the different alternatives available to them. They could colonize a frontier area and settle the area with a new population, but it's always going to be more valuable for states to simply exploit the pre-existing labor or try and trade with a population in the frontier than it is to settle that territory with a new population. And this was evident even during kind of the height of British colonization. There was a famous select committee in the 1830s in the British Parliament that investigated kind of native policy across the empire. And this committee, you know, looked at the British decision to open up land in southern Africa for a British settlement. And it was really damning of the decision of Britain to do so to clear the Xhosa in southern Africa, because it had noted that the decision to do so inflamed conflict with the indigenous nation and led to the kind of disruption of trade with that nation for a long period of time. And all that Britain gained, in their words, was a small patch of land that could have been bought for a trifle. So colonization, essentially by trying to push a population into a frontier, inflames conflict with the pre-existing population. And so it's actually a very costly thing for state to do. And so I dug into a lot of the cases where, you know, people thought that there was a clear interest of European colonizers to settle frontier areas like Australia. It's not clear when you dig into the historical evidence that states actually saw at the time that colonization was something that was economically in their interest to do. In fact, when I delve into the kind of case of Australia, the first time that Britain kind of opened up, in scare quotes, land for British settlement was when British settlers were moving into frontier areas against the wishes of the state. And the state feared that they would, these settlers would kind of overextend the state, and they didn't want to and lead to a large degree of conflict on the frontier, which is not something they wanted at the time. So you can't just read back into colonization projects the intentions of states, that thinking that it's always in their economic interests, because actually colonization is something that's a costly practice. And so we have to think about the alternatives available to states and why states might colonize. And to do so, we have to think about what's going on the ground and how the actions of settlers might kind of alter the interests of states.
So then let's think about what's happening on the ground, because you outline a triangle of interests that you show and discuss that makes this all make a lot more sense. So can you walk us through kind of this triangle and how it operates?
Yeah, so the main distinction that I make is that we have to distinguish the interests of states. States do have an interest in kind of controlling maximal territory at minimal costs, and they want to kind of exploit the populations and labor and resources of a frontier. And then you have the interests of settlers, and settlers want land. And then you finally have the indigenous population who want political autonomy. And so the worst thing for them is for their land to be kind of taken by settlers. And distinguishing between these kind of three actors, this kind of triangle of actors, helps us understand cases like Australia in the 1830s, when settlers began moving into frontier areas of their own volition, which was actually against the kind of intentions and interests of the British state at the time. And it also helps us understand cases where states do want to settle frontier areas, like Australia and Papua New Guinea, but settlers don't move to those areas. So kind of distinguishing between states and settlers kind of opens us up to understanding, you know, when those interests are aligned, when states want to recruit settlers to move to frontier areas and they're successful, when settlers move into those areas of their own volition and the kind of state has to decide whether to authorize those settlements or not, as well as cases where states try and recruit settlers but fail to do so.
Before we get into the case studies, I suppose, because I do obviously want to ask you rather a lot about them, given that triangle, is there perhaps an example you could walk us through to sort of illustrate how this works?
Yeah. So I make a kind of typology. So cases of what I call settler-led colonization are kind of the cases like Australia in the 1830s that I described before. So in the 1830s, Britain controlled mainly the area of Sydney and Tasmania, and Britain had sent a number of kind of penal colonists to that area, basically in order to prevent France from annexing Australia. But in the 1830s, kind of a number of British settlers, chafing at the kind of restrictions on settlements to the areas immediately around Sydney and Tasmania, sailed and set up a new settlement in present-day Melbourne. And this created a kind of crisis on the part of the British state, as there were a number of letters that between Sydney and London whereby British officials basically had to decide whether they wanted to send soldiers to displace those settlers or whether they were going to authorize the kind of settlements. And that's a kind of, this is a dynamic of what I call settler-led colonization, when settlers are moving into frontier areas and states essentially have to decide whether they're going to authorize those settlements or not. And this is often called homesteading in the United States, in the Western United States, whereby the state kind of follows the settlers. The settlers begin moving into frontier areas because they want land, and the state has to decide whether it will protect those settlers and kind of from attacks from the indigenous population, or whether they will try and restrict settlement. And this is quite different to what I call state-led colonization. So in cases of state-led colonization, it's actually the state that is recruiting settlers, that is designating sites for settlement, that is actively displacing the indigenous populations in the frontier. And you know, one example, you know, going back in a similar time period, would be Britain in British settlements in Northern Ireland. So right around the same time period as kind of Britain began settling North America, Britain also settled tens of thousands of Protestants into Northern Ireland. And it did so, and it set up a kind of elaborate settlement scheme whereby it carved up the land and allocated each plot to a different settler. And it did so because, and these kind of state-led colonization practices, I argue, often occur in response to a threat. So a state fears that it's going to essentially lose control over a frontier area if it doesn't quickly import a population from the core into the frontier, and it doesn't trust the indigenous population, who might be seen as kind of allegiant to a foreign power or who are actively engaged in a rebellion. And so they want to displace that population and quickly import a kind of new population from the frontier. And that's what was happening in Northern Ireland in the 1600s, where the Spanish Armada had almost invaded Britain, and a number of kind of Irish lords had just joined forces with Spain to try and rebel against Britain, these Irish lords were Catholics. And so Britain essentially decided to that the key solution to kind of pacifying Northern Ireland would be to Protestantize that area to displace all the Catholics and import tens of thousands of Protestants. And so these kind of state-led colonization practices, I argue, going right back to the Roman Empire, you know, usually occur along frontier areas where states kind of don't have much control, and they fear that if they don't quickly import a population from the core, they'll lose control over the area. And so and unlike kind of settler-led colonization, state-led colonization is still occurring to the current day. So I spend a lot of time in the book talking about cases like Indonesia and West Papua, whereby the state actively recruited settlers, designated sites for settlement. And it did so because, as I describe in the book, in the 1980s, there was a major rebellion in West Papua that almost succeeded in capturing the regional capital. And this insurgency was led by a number of groups that were based in Papua New Guinea. And the response of the Indonesia was basically to colonize the borderland with Papua New Guinea to prevent any insurgents from crossing the border by displacing all the indigenous Papuans from the borderland and settling those areas with Javanese and Balinese, members of ethnic groups whom the Indonesian state considered more loyal. And so that's the main distinction I make, is between kind of settler-led colonization practices, which occur in response to the kind of interests of state of settlers into kind of gaining land on the frontier, and state-led colonization, which is usually a response to conflict and a crisis of kind of control.
And speaking about the cases in the book, I think that was definitely one of the strengths, is the kind of breadth over space and time that you look at. Could you just kind of list out, I suppose, for us, which cases you cover, and then explain how did you choose them? Choosing cases is always the tricky part.
Yeah, no, for sure. So you're right. In the book, I do kind of theorize from a number of cases, especially like in the front and back ends. But the key cases that I study to kind of examine logics of state-led colonization are China. So I look at China's settlement projects in Xinjiang, and Xinjiang is an area where the proportion of Han Chinese went from about 5%, and Han Chinese are the kind of dominant ethnic group in China. So Han Chinese went from about 5% to about 40% in Xinjiang in the course of about two or three decades in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So it was a major change in Xinjiang's demography. And I spend a lot of time studying essentially where China sent people, why it sent people to particular areas at particular points in time and not others in Xinjiang. And I also look at both the kind of crisis that China faced in the 1960s when it was conflicting with the Soviet Union during the so-called Sino-Soviet split. And I show how China settled ethnically Russian areas as well as areas that it feared that the Soviet Union could easily invade from Kazakhstan into Xinjiang. And then I look at China's shift in the 1990s in a separate chapter. Essentially, since the 1990s, China's faced a long-running Islamist insurgency, and it's begun to try and settle Uyghur and Muslim-majority areas, and these areas are in the south of Xinjiang, unlike the kind of Russian-dominated areas in the north of Xinjiang. And I look at how China has tried to recruit settlers to kind of southern Xinjiang since then in response to this kind of crisis of control. And two other chapters examine this juxtaposition between Indonesia and Australia and New Guinea. So essentially, I draw on a lot of data to examine why is it that Indonesia settled West Papua in the 1980s and 90s, and why did it settle some areas and not others? And I look at Australia's settlements in Papua New Guinea throughout the 20th century, as well as the Northern Territory, which is the northern half of Australia. And I look at why Australia tried to settle those areas and why it failed to kind of colonize those areas with whites. And the reason I chose those cases was essentially because, you know, as social scientists, we like to rule out alternative explanations. So studying, you know, one province like Xinjiang over a long period of time helps me kind of rule out alternative explanations and better identify, you know, why China settled the north at this time and the south at this time. And similarly for New Guinea, because the geographic conditions of the island are identical either side, I can basically explain why Indonesia settled West Papua, but Australia did not settle Papua New Guinea.
So because the data for that chapter in particular I found really fascinating, I hope you don't mind if I ask a bit of a follow-up on that particular point for Indonesia. Why did Indonesia settle some areas and not others?
Yeah, so essentially Indonesia primarily settled the border areas with Papua New Guinea because Papua New Guinea was a base for West Papuan insurgents, the kind of independence movement. And so it wanted to cut off cross-border movements, and it was unable to basically distinguish who was an insurgent and who wasn't. So it treated all Papuans along the borderland as potential insurgents and cleared them from the borderland and settled the borderland with Javanese settlers. And so the borderland between West Papua and Papua New Guinea is today the most kind of settler-predominated and Muslim-majority area of West Papua. And it also settled the most resource-rich areas of West Papua. So especially the area around the Grasberg gold mine, which is the kind of largest gold mine in the world and is the second largest copper mine in the world and generates about 50% of West Papua's gross domestic product every year. So half the wealth in West Papua comes from this one site, which makes it very strategically important to the Indonesian state, which extracted millions, hundreds of millions of dollars from Grasberg over the late 20th century. So essentially, Indonesia wanted to establish control around that resource-rich site. And so I show how, following the discovery of this mine, it cleansed the area around the mine of tens of thousands of West Papuans and began to settle that area with about 20,000 people from the rest of Indonesia. And so essentially, it colonized the mine site to establish control over that area, as it feared that without doing so, the mine could be easily disabled by West Papuan insurgents.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Thank you for explaining that. Obviously, all the case studies I found really interesting, but the kind of precision of the data being able to rule out alternative explanations in that case was really quite cool. And for listeners who are thinking of reading the book, the visualization of this makes it even more dramatically apparent what's happening. So we definitely kind of recommend that chapter for anyone wanting to see this literally in more detail.
Totally. It was I was surprised to see how porous and how detailed the Indonesian government's data was. Surprised and not surprised, like, states put a lot of money into funding colonization. So it's in some ways unsurprising that they would spend quite a bit of money tracking, settlers and where they were sent. And so Indonesia collected data, very precise data on exactly how many settlers were sent to exactly what farm and exactly what year. And so, as you were saying, I can really reconstruct that colonization program in very precise detail.
Mm. And in a lot of ways, that kind of precision and the interest that the state has in kind of having this policy be exactly the way they wanted raises some interesting questions that we've sort of touched on a little bit, but I'd like to get in more specifically the idea that state-led colonization, there's often a fear component around territorial insecurity. And in some of the examples you've mentioned, kind of ethnicity keeps coming up, right? The idea of in Northern Ireland, Protestant populations are kind of particularly important, Javanese or Balinese, that it's not just any settlers that the state is trying to move into a particular place, but there's particular identity criteria. So could you tell us more about state-led colonization and this intersection with ethnicity and territorial insecurity?
Yeah, so ethnicity in periods of conflict, takes on in ethically diverse areas, takes on a really important signifier because in settings like Ireland in the 1500s or 1600s or Britain at that time, as I'm sure you're aware, your identity as a Protestant or Catholic was a really important signifier of your likely political allegiance, whether that was to, you know, Queen Elizabeth, or whether it was to the Pope, for instance. And this is true in Indonesia and West Papua too. You know, whether you're in a setting of conflict where states are unable to distinguish between friend or foe, whether you're an indigenous Papuan or whether you're a Javanese, becomes a kind of stereotypical proxy for whether you're likely to be allegiant to the state or whether you're likely to be allegiant to a hostile power. And so it's in these settings of conflict and ethnically diverse frontiers where states unable to determine who's friend or foe, that they're particularly likely to want to use ethnicity as an ethnic change, as a kind of barometer of their control. And so changing the ethnic balance of a contested frontier becomes a way of consolidating control over a frontier area when you're otherwise unable to determine, you know, who's going to be allegiant to you or who's not. And that's why we see ethnicity play such an important role in colonization projects, because it's a signal of your political loyalty or not to the state or to a foreign state. I'll provide another example. In Cyprus, for instance, there's been a huge amount of demographic change over the last 60 years as Greece and Turkey have conflicted over control of Cyprus. And Cyprus used to be formerly really ethnically heterogeneous. There were ethnic Turks, there were Turkish speakers, there were Greek speakers. But in the 1970s, following this kind of crisis between Turkey and Greece, both Greece and Turkey saw kind of the ethnic balance as a likely barometer of, you know, where it is they're going to be able to consolidate control over. And so Turkey began to actively settle the areas that it controlled in northern Cyprus with ethnic Turks and displace ethnic Greeks, as that was seen as a way of kind of getting rid of the disloyal population and populating with a loyal population. And similarly for Greeks in Cyprus, getting rid of ethnic Turks. In these settings, ethnically diverse settings, your ethnic identity during conflict becomes a kind of visible and highly visible signifier of who you're allegiant to. And that's why, you know, even we see ethnicity becoming, you know, playing this important role in conflict, you know, well before we often think of the emergence of race and nationalism. Machiavelli in the 1500s was, in the Prince, was writing about how when states kind of annex ethnically heterogeneous areas, they should displace areas that are populated by ethnic groups or people who speak like a foreign state, and populate people who are like your own. Because ever since antiquity, states kind of have the group that forms the majority kind of or core group, what you speak, what cultural practices you have, how you look, becomes a stereotypically associated with that state. And so whether you speak a certain language, whether you look a certain way, becomes a signal of who you're likely allegiant to. And so that's why I say, you know, in state building in ethnically diverse areas often becomes a form of demographic chess, as states, you know, use ethnicity as a proxy for the extent of their control.
And this is, of course, very true today in Xinjiang. And as you show in the book, both in decades past in northern Xinjiang and very much today in southern Xinjiang. But as much as that case study in and of itself, tracing the change over time in Xinjiang, was fascinating, perhaps even more intriguing was the compare and contrast that you've done between Australia's Northern Territory and Papua New Guinea, and that colonization effort that happened, obviously is not happening quite so currently, with what China's doing kind of right now in southern Xinjiang. So I was wondering if you could sort of take us through these two places that seem quite different in terms of time and place, but actually there's a lot of similarities between the colonization efforts.
Yeah. So, you know, recall that, you know, earlier, the main distinction I made was right between states and settlers. And in periods of conflict, states might want to quickly settle frontier areas that are ethnically diverse, populated by kind of a stereotypically disloyal population, or at least provide a first line of defense against a potential invader. But it's because settlers have their own distinct interests, they might not be able to be actually able to attract people and settlers to move from the core to the frontier. And the argument I make in the book, and one of the kind of key arguments, is that this difficulty in attracting settlers becomes much more difficult as states become more developed. So essentially, in pre-industrial areas, it's really easy to colonize as land is the most valuable asset. And so it's very easy to attract agriculturalists to move to contested frontiers by simply clearing a population and opening up land for your kind of core group. And that was true, for instance, of Indonesia and its transmigration policies in the 20th century, where it resettled about 5 million people across the rest of the archipelago. This program was oversubscribed, as people wanted to take up land, especially if you were landless agriculturalist in Java. If you could get a piece of land in the frontier, you can improve your livelihood. So it's very easy to colonize. And that was true of China for most of its history too, and of Australia. But something changes as states develop and industrialize. Essentially, one of the kind of iron laws, one of the few, very few iron laws that exist in social science, is that as states economically develop, they become more urban. Industry and jobs and other things become centered in cities, and people no longer want to engage in farm labor and take up land in the frontier. And so essentially, I extend this insight by basically arguing that as states develop, it becomes increasingly difficult for them to settle contested frontiers even when they want to. And so this helps explain that big question you pose at the start of the book. Why do states like Australia or China or the United States stop colonizing? Well, it's because they become too economically developed. They can no longer attract people to frontier areas with the promise of free land or other subsidies, as everyone wants to move to major cities like Shanghai, like Melbourne, like Sydney. And that's essentially what I describe in two chapters of the book. I make this unusual comparison between southern Xinjiang and Australia's Northern Territory and Papua New Guinea, which were both cases where states actively wanted to get people to move to the frontier, but couldn't get people to move there. So for China and southern Xinjiang, since the 1990s, it's seen the Uyghur population, the Muslim population, as disloyal and has wanted to move Han Chinese into those areas in order to, quote-unquote, rectify the demography. But essentially, it's been unable to get many people to move there, as most of the migration since that time has been to China's eastern seaboard, and Han Chinese settlers have been scared off by the number of kind of terrorist attacks and the kind of creation of the security state there. So it's been really difficult for the Chinese state to actually reshape the demography of southern Xinjiang and to colonize that area with settlers since the 1990s. And that was true of Australia as well in its earlier period of development as well. So Australia in the mid 20th century faced a really key threat from Japan and of invasion. And so in response to this threat in the 30s and 40s, Australia really tried to recruit settlers to move into the Northern Territory, kind of northern part of Australia's mainland, as well as to Papua New Guinea, to especially former soldiers to provide a first line of defense against a future invasion. But it was unable to get people to move there. And so there's this paradoxical thing going on that as states become wealthier, as states like China and Australia become these wealthy, very strong, very capable states that, you know, can lock down whole cities in a moment, actually become much weaker at other dimensions, which specifically at controlling migration and colonizing, because it can't incentivize people to uproot their lives from cities and move to frontier areas anymore, which forces them to rely on other strategies to either give up control over those frontier areas, like Australia did in Papua New Guinea, or ultimately turn to mass incarceration and genocide, as China did in Xinjiang.
thank you for comparing those two cases. It's a really interesting one that demonstrates exactly this problem, that state-led does not necessarily mean successful. The state has a lot of things at their disposal, but cannot necessarily force people, or at least might not choose to undertake the amount of costs needed to force people. And so this obviously tells us something about the conditions under which colonization is successful, that there's an kind of a level of development aspect to it that can both, if a country's less developed, perhaps enable colonization or get in the way once urbanization's really undertaken. Are there any other conditions that these two examples in particular demonstrate that colonization sort of needs to work?
Yeah, so the existence of willing settlers is the only necessary and sufficient condition for colonization, right? Because if settlers are willing to move to a frontier, then there might be settler-led colonization. They might be moving into those areas, and the state is forced to kind of either annex those areas or prevent the settlers from doing so. And so that's the kind of, it's a sufficient condition, and it's a necessary condition as well, because states can only colonize when they have willing settlers. And so that's why economic development is kind of the key factor, I argue, to understand when states colonize, because as they develop, that the settlers change from being willing to being unwilling. And so states are effectively unable to colonize, and these kind of settler-led and state-led colonization disappear. I delve into, you know, the case like Australia and Papua New Guinea, where the internal debates at the time of whether to colonize Northern Territory or Papua New Guinea are really fascinating, because they tell us a lot about why Australia ultimately decided not to colonize Papua New Guinea, because a number of economists estimated it would cost about $1 million per settler to attract white Europeans to Papua New Guinea, because they would have to construct all kinds of modern infrastructure, like hospitals, like schools, like roads, like everything else that that people would want in a modern urban state. And they estimated that would be, so essentially to attract, you know, the equivalent number of people that Indonesia attracted to West Papua, Australia would have to spend $300 billion, whereas Indonesia had to only spend a small fraction of that to attract 300,000 people to West Papua. So economic development is really the kind of key factor in explaining where the conditions under which state colonize. And the existence of conflict is in some ways the other key factor to explain state-led colonization. So, you know, even in like states that aren't very developed, like across sub-Saharan Africa, you don't see a lot of kind of state-led colonization today, because you don't see those kind of territorial conflicts that are to the same level that you see in parts of Asia. So, for instance, the conflicts between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, or Morocco in Western Sahara, or between Thailand and Malaysia over the southern Malay areas, or between Indonesia and Malaysia over kind of Borneo. These are all areas where states are really actively fighting over territory. And that you don't see that in sub-Saharan Africa, where the African Union really froze the colonial borders. And so the kind of existence of conflict is the territorial conflict specifically, and kind of issues around border control and secession, and the fear of secession is the other kind of key factor to explain when states colonize.
So obviously the kind of that last part of your answer goes into it already. So I'd love to ask a bit more explicitly about how your theory is applicable beyond the in-depth case studies that you go into in the book and that you've explained to us here.
Yeah. So, I spend a kind of, after I do the in-depth case studies, I spend a chapter kind of surveying, where it is that indigenous peoples around the world today are actively being displaced but from their lands by settlers. And what you see is that these tend to be less developed countries where there are ongoing territorial conflicts. So whether that's Morocco in Western Sahara, Sri Lanka in the Tamil areas, Indonesia in West Papua, India in its northeast in Kashmir, Iraqi settlement in Kurdistan, and a Bangladeshi settlement in the Chittagong Hills, or China in Xinjiang in Tibet. All of these areas kind of share certain similarities, where they're countries that are less developed, but also have a highly populous core, where people are kind of willing to move to frontier areas if they're given free land. And there's a kind of desire on the states to actively change the demography of frontier areas, because they fear that if they don't do so, that those areas will secede or be captured by a foreign claimant. And I also spend a bit of time delving into the case of Israel. In that chapter, I show essentially that to explain these patterns across the world, you know, where it is indigenous peoples are being displaced by settlers, it tends to be it only tends to occur in countries where the GDP per capita is less than $6,000 US dollars, roughly, which is kind of a middle income country today. It doesn't really matter if you're a democracy or not, or other factors don't really seem to explain this, you know, why it is that colonization happens in these conflict zones in less developed countries. But Israel is this big outlier. So Israel is the only highly developed country that still engages in colonization today and ethnic cleansing. And so why is that? And, I kind of delve into the Israeli case and say that Israel is, you know, in some ways it shares the factors of that kind of explain colonization or state-led colonization, because there's this ongoing territorial conflict where ethnicity is highly salient and is a signal of your political loyalty. So changing the ethnic balance is a form of territorial consolidation. But the strange thing about Israel is that it's been able to get people to move to frontier areas. That's what really is unique about Israel. And what's unique about Israel and what explains its ability to get people to move to frontier areas is its unusual geography. So with the West Bank and East Jerusalem are so close to Jerusalem that Israel has basically been able to settle much of the West Bank and East Jerusalem by displacing Palestinians and offering subsidized mortgages to Israeli urbanites. And these settlers the vast majority of surveys show that are economically motivated. These are settlers who just want to take up subsidized mortgages and are moving to the West Bank because it's cheaper for them to do so. These settlers are basically still able to access Jerusalem, still able to access a major urban center where they can work, where they can access modern services. And so that's what's really unusual about Israel, is that it's this territorial conflict is occurring in such a small area where it's really almost as if like London was trying to colonize Brighton, or Melbourne is trying to colonize the Mornington Peninsula, or Los Angeles is trying to colonize the Orange County. Like this area is so close to the urban center that it's easy to get to incentivize people to move there with subsidized mortgages. And that's what makes it so different to, say, Australia's failure in Papua New Guinea, or China's failure in Xinjiang, or Portugal's failure in Angola, or the United States' failure to colonize the Philippines. These areas were far more distant from urban centers, and so the state had a much greater difficulty attracting settlers. So that's what's really unusual about Israel. And I also kind of just, go further and discuss the case of Gaza, because Gaza is a case that does really illustrate my theory well. So Israel, unlike in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, really struggled to colonize Gaza in the 1970s and 80s. It struggled to attract large numbers of Jewish settlers there. And this ultimately presented a crisis for the Israeli state, because Gaza was relatively distant from any urban center. It was 2 hours drive to Jerusalem. And the small number of Israeli settlers there, about 15,000, were outweighed massively by the kind of million strong Palestinian population. And this was a kind of crisis. This presented a crisis for the Israeli state. in 2005. And Israel's response, much like Australia's response in Papua New Guinea, was ultimately to cleave off Gaza from the rest of the Israeli state. And, you know, the Israeli leaders at this time even said they were doing so because of demography, because they were recognizing the fact that they couldn't get Jewish people to move there and that they could never outweigh the Arab population. And that was true for the for Australia and Papua New Guinea too. So, you know, states that are highly developed, like Israel, Australia, really struggle to colonize areas that are relatively distant from any urban center, even if that distance is, say, 2 hours.
Thank you for explaining that. I think it does really illustrate the theory and also explain kind of how Israel fits into this. Often the idea of Israel being an exception might actually, in some, you know, in some ways that's true, right? Israel is developed and yet they are still colonizing. But also the way in which they are an exception very much is explained through the theory, given the geographic proximity. So I kind of want to bring in something that we've, I guess in some ways mentioned, or at least it's implied, but haven't talked about directly, which is, of course, the idea of economic development, of urbanization, are all taking place in the context of the actual economic paradigm that we're in, right, of capitalism. So let's sort of link that, right? We've talked about the relationship between successful colonization from the state and what that relates to in terms of economic development. So what can we then say in terms of decolonization and how that relates to stages of capitalism?
Yeah, that's right. So that so essentially, we can just return to that paradox that I mentioned at the start. Why did Australia decolonize Papua New Guinea, right? Why did it allow Papua New Guineans independence? Or why did the United States decolonize the Philippines? Or why did Portugal decolonize Angola? Yeah, in some ways, this is a paradox because for Marxist theories for a long time, you know, especially Lenin, famously linked capitalism to imperialism. So essentially, Lenin believed, writing in the early 20th century, that as states develop, they would essentially grow so powerful that the world would eventually be divided into two or three states. But in fact, what we've seen over the last century is the opposite happened. After 1945, we saw a fragmentation of European empires, the American state, the Australian state, and the formation of all these new nation states. And paradoxically, it was in these highly developed states that decolonization actually occurred. So, you know, Australia ended up being a decolonizer in New Guinea, for instance. And so it's for this reason that I say we should invert Lenin's famous claim that imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism, whereas my book actually argues that decolonization is the highest stage of capitalism. Because essentially, following decolonization, we can define as indigenous self-determination, the process by which indigenous peoples gain control over land and independence. And indigenous peoples only have this ability when their lands are not being taken by settlers, when they're not being colonized. And so the kind of absence of colonization, the prevention of colonization, becomes a precondition for decolonization. And states only stop colonizing when they become economically developed. So in some ways, economic development provides this kind of critical precondition for decolonization. As Australia only decolonized Papua New Guinea after it failed to colonize it, when it failed to attract white settlers there. Indonesia, on the other hand, has not decolonized West Papua. It has not granted the indigenous peoples there self-determination or independence because it's been in such an effective colonizer, because it's simply been able to displace indigenous peoples and settle their lands with members of kind of ethnic groups like the Javanese and Balinese. So decolonization in some ways emerges as the highest stage of capitalism, because when states stop colonizing, they are forced to confront seriously for the first time, as Australia did in Papua New Guinea or as Israel did in Gaza, what do you do with this population who is in the frontier, who are not considered core members of the state? Do you grant them citizenship and allow them to become full and equal members of the society, or do you grant them independence? And that's essentially the story of how I show why it is that European states ended up granting independence to so much of their kind of former colonial possessions because they had this kind of crisis, they didn't want to grant equal citizenship and allow people in their empires to emigrate to the metropole to vote in their own elections. And so granting them independence became the kind of best option in the absence of being able to colonize.
Thank you for taking us through kind of how those things relate to each other. Again, kind of going back to what we talked about at the beginning, that there are traditional answers to these questions, but when poked at, they don't quite add up, which is why the book is absolutely fascinating on that score. But weirdly, that brings me to my last question, which is not actually about the book particularly. Slightly unfair question, because this book has literally just come out. But it is now out. People can read it. So is there anything you might be working on now or next that you'd like to share with the audience, whether or not it's a book? Is there anything you'd like people to be aware of?
Yeah. So I'm currently working on a project that basically builds off that, from that last comment, right, which is to explain decolonization. And because really what my book is, this book has shown, is that economic development results in the end of colonization. But there's still variation, right, in how European states ended up decolonizing indigenous peoples. In some areas, like Australia or Papua New Guinea, they did grant indigenous peoples independence. The same for United States in the Philippines. But in other areas, that wasn't true. So Australia, you know, never really granted indigenous peoples independence in other parts of its territory, or for the United States in Guam, for instance. And so my belief is that, you know, and the same for France too. You know, France in the 50s famously, like, only extended kind of metropolitan equality and citizenship to relatively small islands like Martinique, like Guadeloupe, like New Caledonia, whilst refusing equality and the rights of indigenous peoples to migrate to France and to vote in French elections to relatively larger colonies like Vietnam or Mozambique, Madagascar. So, you know, I think there's something here that I think is interesting, whereby kind of population, again, this kind of demography, and can explain the process of decolonization, whereby states granted citizenship and equality to indigenous peoples from relatively small colonies, but granted independence to indigenous peoples to relatively large colonies. And that this was in their own interest to do so, because they wanted to prevent the indigenous peoples in large colonies from kind of entering the metropole and migrating to the metropole. So decolonization, contrary to how we often think about it, can often be a top-down process and utilized by the metropole to kind of further its own interests and prevent people from kind of gaining equality, citizenship, migration rights, and voting rights.
Fascinating. Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us. I really do, for listeners who are intrigued by this conversation, the book again is titled Settling for Less: Why States Colonize and Why They Stop. If you've been intrigued by anything we've discussed, I would strongly recommend reading the full book. There's lots of really interesting detail that further illuminates this theory and helps understand these two very important questions that somehow you've put in the same book, and it's not 800 pages long. So congratulations for that as well. It's actually quite readable.
Thanks. You know, I did, yes, on that note, yes, do not fear that it is a weighty tome. I really tried to make this a good read and a quick read.
It is certainly concise, and also I have to say, very much appreciated how clearly structured it is. You always know why you're telling us this thing, and how does this link to something else, and what's the point of it? There was no point where I was going, I don't understand why this page has what it has on it. So that also really helps with readability to any listeners who are considering it. But that kind of brings us to the end of the interview. So Lachlan, thank you so much for your time and being with us on the podcast.
Oh no, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for letting me share my work.